Hey, NOG Gamma Mouse 338B. What's up, man? How you been?
Oh, hi, AR16 Mouse 11118-Z. I was just looking over my deployment orders.
Oh, you got picked for an experiment. That's awesome. What is it?
Well, they're going to induce depression in me and then remove my brain and test for levels of some kind of messenger RNA in my hippocampus.
Okay, well, you know, that could be sort of cool, right?
Why? What experiment are you in?
Well, it's just the words with the cooks.
I didn't catch that.
All right, they're going to feed us Oreos and see how addicted we get.
And then what?
I don't know. Maybe we go to Betty Ford.
I don't believe this.
I know. I really lucked out. My uncle Mickey knows somebody on the board at Conn College, so...
Mickey Mouse is your uncle.
Yeah, I don't like to make a big deal of it, okay?
Now I'm really depressed.
Oof, don't tell them that. If I were in your paws, I'd take a really long time to get depressed. Then maybe they'll run out of funding. Meanwhile, here's a show about the lives of animals and research. And now, the star of the chronic stress-induced alternations in mouse defecation study, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, they got some pretty good results out of me on that one. All right, so yeah, we decided that we would... All of this was kind of triggered last week by a very much publicized study done at Connecticut College. And it got us talking a little bit about just the state of animal research and where it is. I was writing a lot about this kind of thing, I think maybe around the 1980s or so, but I haven't really thought about it very much recently. And we kind of wondered just, first of all, how animals are being used these days. And I think in particular, you know, are we moving into more of a 21st century model where animals will be used any less in scientific research? So what we're going to do today is, first of all, tell you about one study. It'll be that Connecticut College study. We're going to tell you also just in general about a little bit more about the protocols for how animals are handled in laboratories. Towards the end, we're also going to talk to the president and CEO of the Humane Society, which actually tries to stay in kind of a dialogue with the scientific community about the use of animals in research. So all of that, and we also welcome your questions, your comments, 860-275-7266. Let me tell you some of the people you'll be talking to. One of them is Dr. Bob Adams. He's an associate professor in the Department of Molecular and Comparative Pathobiology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Actually, many of these names and titles are difficult to say in one breath. Dr. Mark Mattson, also a chief of the Laboratory of Neurosciences at the National Institute on Aging, also a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. Right now, we're going to begin our conversation with Dr. Joseph Schroeder. He is the chair of the Animal Care and Use Committee and director of the Laboratory Animal Care Facility at Conn College. He's also the guy who can really tell us a little something about that very much celebrated Oreo study that just got all over the press last week. So, Dr. Schroeder, first of all, welcome to the show, and tell us how you came, or you and your students came to be studying Oreos and rats.
Glad to be here. So the study originated last year. It was actually the idea of my student, Jamie Hanahan. She was a behavioral neuroscience major at the college, and we have a very strong history of close student-faculty collaboration especially for the sciences. Jamie was also a member of the college's Hollerin Center, which is for students interested in public policy, community action, and social justice issues, and was interested in the obesity epidemic and the evidence suggesting that obesity is more prevalent in urban, low socioeconomic status populations. And also the connecting that with the availability of food choices in those environments, which typically does not have a lot of grocery stores with fresh, healthy foods, and instead food options are limited to high-fat, high-sugar processed food and fast food restaurants. So she was interested in my research on psychostimulant addiction models, and we use a very simple, straightforward procedure called conditioned place preference, which assesses the association between the pleasurable aspects of oftentimes drugs of abuse, but it can be used basically for anything, and a specific environment.
So just in layman's terms, basically what we're talking about, and you had done research, I think, with cocaine and morphine, where the rats went to a certain place, got the cocaine and morphine, but then when the cocaine and morphine and or morphine supply dried up, there wasn't any more for them, they still went to the place. They liked that place a lot better than they liked another place. And so basically this was done, the same thing was done with Oreos, and if I have it correctly, Rice Cakes, right? Even after the animals stopped getting Oreos, they still liked that place where the Oreos used to be.
That's basically correct. We based our study off of a published study which used Oreos and Rice Cakes to evaluate condition place preference. So it wasn't coming out of left field. It was a peer-reviewed study that we wanted to extend upon. And we basically showed the same thing that this other study had shown, that animals can be conditioned to high-fat, high-sugar foods, and we chose Oreos because they had chosen Oreos, but we could have very easily chosen any high-fat, high-sugar foods, because when you ingest those types of foods, which are very palatable and give you pleasure, it stimulates the brain's pleasure center in a similar manner to drugs of abuse.
One of the things that you did then, just to sort of home in on that a little bit, is you looked at the brains of the animals afterwards, right? Did you look at them through an MRI, or did you remove the brains and look at them?
The animals were euthanized immediately after we finished assessing their behavior, so that we could have a snapshot of their brain when they were experiencing this pleasure, and that allows us to look at the expression of a protein called CFOS, which is basically an indicator of cellular activation. So we used an immunohistochemical procedure to assess CFOS protein expression, and found that in the animals that were exposed to or conditioned to the high-fat, high-sugar foods, had a slightly greater, but it was statistically significant, expression of CFOS than the animals that were conditioned to cocaine or morphine. So it suggests that their pleasure center in their brains was activated at least as strong, if not stronger, than animals that were conditioned to cocaine or morphine.
Right now, there's somebody at Nabisco trying to figure out how they can use that in their advertising. I don't know that they can do it without.
So I must stress that this research was done with undergraduates at a small liberal arts college, and it has not been through the peer review process. It's just a preliminary study that hasn't been vetted yet by peer review.
And that point has been made, and a lot of the coverage of it on the internet and in the news. Obviously, Khan College is a great school, but it's not a huge teeming research institution, right? It's not gigantic. You can't be doing a whole bunch of animal studies all at once.
True. We have fewer than 2,000 students in 4 years.
Does that condition the choice of the animal model you're going to use? Do you just wind up using one animal rather than having to maintain a whole bunch of species?
We have a small lab animal facility at the college that allows us to do research with rats, but it's not big enough that we can house separate species just because of its size, and that's the number of species that you can house is dictated by the USDA in terms of your facilities.
You know, now if I had sort of a Peter Singer type philosopher objector to animal research on this show right now, probably what he would be saying is, well, do you as a scientist, as a researcher, do any kind of, for want of a better term, moral analysis of this? Do you sort of think, well, is this study, which is not going to be peer-reviewed, which is going to be conducted by undergraduates, which is going to replicate some of the findings of an Ontario study and maybe go a little bit further, is this worth asking X number of rats to lay down their lives for? I mean, to what degree do you think about that, and to what degree would that kind of thinking be an impediment to pure research?
Well, the use of animals is very important for someone who's trying to study behavior from a neurobiological standpoint. And at any place where there is animal research, there has to be an internal animal care and use committee, which evaluates any proposal that's done with animals to ensure that they're first treated ethically and that the study is reasonable and is going to answer or attempt to answer some novel questions that haven't been addressed before. And only then do we get permission to do those studies.
Now, we should let's sort of add some other voices to the conversation. Let's start out with Bob Adams. He's, as I said before, associate professor in the Department of Molecular and Comparative Pathobiology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Dr. Adams, you're involved, obviously, with a somewhat larger pool of research animals. Tell us what there is at Johns Hopkins.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm the director of Research Animal Resources, and as such, we oversee the care for the animals across the entire university. So we care for everything from mice to small farm animals, swine, sheep, a number of non-human primate species ranging from small ones like marmosets up to large ones like baboons. And we have large numbers of macaques, which are like rhesus monkeys, and two other species. And everything in between. We have birds, we have fish, frogs, rabbits, guinea pigs, a wide range of species.
Now, imagine that I'm a researcher at Johns Hopkins, and I want to do some kind of research, and I think I know what animal model I want to use. Do I have to talk you or some kind of committee into the idea that I need pigs instead of lizards? I mean, in
yes.
other words, yes, you do. And what kind of sort of evaluation goes into your decision-making on that?
Well, I think I need to make sure you understand. The investigators usually know the literature quite well
sure.
in the field that they're working in. So they'll know what the models are and what the preferred species is.
Mm-hmm.
So what they have to convince the committee, which you've already heard, is they have to convince the committee that what they're doing is reasonable, that the animals will be appropriately anesthetized or be given pain-relieving drugs if necessary. They have to tell us how they're going to euthanize the animal. There's a whole bunch of questions that they have to answer, and they have to convince a committee of their peers, which ranges, at least at our institution, there's a number of veterinarians on the committee as well as scientists from different disciplines. And they have to essentially convince us that the work they want to do is reasonable. We do have most of our stuff is peer-reviewed in that it's often or most often funded by the National Institutes of Health. So the funding for these projects has to go through more peer review, and not many of those projects get funded on top of that.
You know, I feel like just in my scant and inadequate reading of medical history that 50, 75 years ago, there was a lot of work being done on a lot of different, often larger species. And I feel as though a lot of that has been transferred to rats and mice, and I suppose to a special degree to so-called humanized mice that have been genetically altered to kind of reproduce certain kinds of human genetic traits. To what degree are rats and mice kind of crowding out other kinds of research animals?
Oh, well, our predominant species is the mouse, and those are mostly transgenic or these genetically altered mice that you're talking about. I've been at Johns Hopkins for 39 years, and when I first came here, we used many more large animals, particularly dogs. And I like to describe the kind of work they were used for, which was often, if you will, plumbing, trying to figure out how to do various techniques, mostly surgical. The reason that the transgenic mouse has become so powerful is that you can mimic human disease in them, and then do all kinds of studies on those animals. Now, the one problem with the mouse is they're small,
mm-hmm.
and there are some things you can't do. You can't do complicated surgical procedures. Transgenic rats are available, but nowhere near the availability as mice. It's a different technique to make them, and it's more difficult. But my prediction is that eventually the rat will come along. We also have transgenic pigs.
Mm-hmm.
There are transgenic monkeys. But you can imagine how expensive those animals get.
Yeah, I want to come back to that expense issue. Just want to flip back to Dr. Schroeder for a second. Listening to all this, Dr. Schroeder, tell us why you use rats. Is there a particular reason why rats are the species of choice at Kahn College and were the species of choice, therefore, for the Oreo study?
Well, as we mentioned, just because of the size of our facility, we're limited to rats only, and we cannot use mice. And we also were basing our study on previously published research. So if we wanted to be able to compare or generalize our findings to to other published studies, which is oftentimes a question for the care and use committees. They want to make sure that you know, you're using established models and established, you know, the literature, and that your findings will have an impact and be able, in terms of being able to be compared to what has already been shown.
Dr. Adams, my sense, once again, as a layperson looking in from the outside is, and I guess maybe my hope as a layperson looking in from the outside, is that you start small and less sentient and work your way up the ladder as the findings warrant. In other words, you don't test something on macaques until, or you don't test out a hypothesis or investigate a hypothesis with macaques until a certain amount of work has been done with other species. I'm sure that's a very crude representation of the reality, but is there kind of a principle at work there along those lines?
Yes. I think in most cases, if investigators can use a less sentient or a lower species, if you will, they will. And for the type of work that's been described with the rats, very often the rat will be the first animal that's used. And if it shows promising results in the rat, they may eventually work their way up to using macaques, because macaques have a brain that's more similar to humans, and it's more readily translated into human efforts.
Now, you work with these macaques. First of all, I'm assuming that mice and rats are also a lot less expensive than them. How much does a research macaque actually cost Johns Hopkins?
Well, we raise a lot of our own, mm-hmm. so they cost between $5,000 and about $6,500 a piece.
That's like half a semester, really. That's a lot. That's a lot of
money. It's the price of an old Mustang.
Yeah. And so explain why you use macaques and what you use them for, because they are actually part of your own research, right?
Yes. Well, my research is pretty much always working with monkeys. And what I do with the animals is I do the live animal part of the work. Mm-hmm. So I will usually, for example, I do work with SIV, which is a simian immunodeficiency virus. It's mm-hmm. the animal model of HIV. And I work with a large team of colleagues ranging from veterinarians to PhD virologists, immunologists. And so I do the live part. I put the virus into the animals. I periodically remove blood, cerebrospinal fluid, lymph nodes, pieces of spleens, things like this. And then they take it to the laboratory. And then they extensively study it in vitro, is what we call it, outside of the live animal. And I do that for a number of projects, mainly because most investigators don't want to work with monkeys. Monkeys are tough, they're dangerous, and they're not very comfortable with them. I am very comfortable with them, so that's why I do that.
And explain why you're comfortable with them, or what does it take, what qualities do you have to be somebody who can work with a macaque?
Well, probably a little bit of craziness, but I came to Johns Hopkins out of practice, small animal practice, so I was very comfortable working with dogs and cats. Monkeys just looked like a very interesting species to work with, so for almost 40 years I've been working with all kinds of monkeys. And they're just very interesting animals to work with. They're fun.
But, you know, for a lot of people, this is, you know, obviously, and we're going to talk towards the end of the gentleman from the Humane Society, but when people get concerned about animal research, often it is, I mean, the more simian, the more primate the animal, the larger the level of concern probably is. So what do you say back? I don't know. You're talking to somebody at a dinner party, a cocktail party. You mention what you do. Maybe somebody kind of recoils or just sort of says, I have a lot of problems with that. What's your answer back to them?
Well, usually I'll say things like, for example, one of the projects I work on is measles virus. Measles virus only affects humans and monkeys. Mm-hmm. So since you can't work on humans, the only alternative is to do it in monkeys. So we're only using monkeys for studies that require that species. You know, and over my career, I've had lots of those kinds of discussions with people, and some come to my way of thinking and some don't.
I mean, also, the other thing about monkeys, from your point of view also as a researcher, as somebody also with a background in live animal care, I mean, monkeys, they're going to have a little bit more of a personality than a rabbit is, or a fish or a frog or a lizard. Does that ever get to be a problem for you as you're doing this kind of invasive work with them?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a problem, but certainly we get attached to them, and we have some that are around for a very long time. We have, as I said, we breed many of our own, so we have breeders that are around for 20 years, and we know them quite well, and most of the time they're named, even though they're identified by numbers. So, yes, people get attached to them, and we get attached to dogs, we get attached to pigs. But, you know, that's the way, that's the name of the game for what I do.
That's Dr. Bob Adams. He's at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We're going to take a little break here, come back with somebody else from Johns Hopkins, Dr. Mark Mattson, chief of the Laboratory of Neuroscience at the National Institute on Aging.
Lab rats, oh lab rats, I'm just looking for the cheese. Maybe some cheddar might make me feel better. Maybe some brie could set me free. I'm just a lab rat, baby, and I'm looking for the cheese.
And we're back. We're talking about animal research. We do hope that you feel comfortable calling in, 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. As I said before, we're going to add to the conversation Dr. Mark Mattson. He's the chief of the Laboratory of Neurosciences at the National Institute on Aging, also a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Mattson, first of all, you're facility is using rats. I keep wanting to say mats and rice. Rats and mice to look at. Maybe I should be studied for something here. Rats and mice to look at things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. I mean, we all now know people whose lives are touched by these diseases. I feel like I know 8 people now with Parkinson's disease, and obviously I want to see progress made. So I'm guessing, and I'm here in Connecticut where Jackson Labs is coming in, although not, I think, with their vast mice facility. But I'm assuming that these humanized mice, these genetically altered mice, allow you to jump several steps ahead in running animal studies that involve things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So now with mice, we can take mutated human genes that cause inherited forms of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's in families that carry the defective gene, and we can put those abnormal human genes in mice. And for example, in the case of Alzheimer's disease, we now have mice that as they get older, they accumulate amyloid protein in their brain. They have learning and memory impairment, and it progresses a lot more rapidly than in humans, so that we can study the changes that occur on a relative to humans very short time scale, so we can then understand what are the molecular changes occurring that are leading to learning and memory impairment. And then we can test therapeutic interventions, whether they be drugs or, in my lab, we do a lot of work on diet and lifestyle factors and how they might impact on the accumulation of the amyloid and the onset of the cognitive problems in the mice. And so this is a way to quickly understand at the molecular level what's going on in the brain in an Alzheimer's-like mouse, and then to develop potential preventative or therapeutic interventions.
You know, you touched off kind of a controversy a while ago with some remarks that you made. I think you were in Atlanta at the time, and you were talking about certain of these research mice, and you basically were suggesting that maybe they weren't of the quality that researchers would find supremely useful. Explain what your issue was with research mice.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work looking at the effects of calorie restriction or intermittent fasting, as well as exercise on the brain. And in both cases, if we reduce the food intake of the mice or put running wheels in their cages, that will slow down the age-related neuronal dysfunction and degeneration in models of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's diseases. And so the bottom line is that the normal conditions for housing laboratory mice and rats is essentially they're couch potatoes. So they can eat as much as they want whenever they want, and they don't have a lot of opportunity, at least for vigorous exercise, although they can move freely around small cages. But it turns out if you put a running wheel in the cage of a mouse, they will run 5 to 10 kilometers in a 24-hour period. So they like to get exercise. So I guess our point there is that the control laboratory animals, they're couch potatoes, and that we think scientists should consider that in interpreting their data and in some cases, it may make a difference in extrapolating to healthy humans, humans who are not couch potatoes anyway.
You know, Dr. Bob Adams, as you're listening to your colleague talk there, this could be a medium-sized problem or it could be a gigantic problem. I mean, if in fact you start really focusing on one animal as the central research organism for an awful lot of medical research, and then that animal turns into a certain kind of animal, I would imagine that it would be cause for concern in the entire research community. What do you think when you hear Dr. Mattson talk about that?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is if I have to provide running wheels for all the mice in my facility, I'm going to have a lot of trouble. Well, that's certainly true. The conditions under which we house these animals is not natural. In our case, they're in cages with super clean air and super clean water, which is unlike the condition that the rest of us live in. But the other thing is what we're trying to limit are variables. We're trying to house the animals under a set of parameters where they're always the same. But listen, you know, this is his field, so I hear what he's saying, and it would be a problem for me to have to provide that, though.
Dr. Mattson, we should probably put a finer point on this because the way that you said it, you might have lost a couple of people who didn't get it. But one of the things that you're really studying basically is what the effect of intermittent fasting is on some of these disorders. You're subjecting these animals to diets where you take food away for 24 hours and then give the food back. And you're finding in these animals pretty substantial amounts of life extension, right?
Yeah, if we begin that type of intermittent fasting protocol that you described, when the animals are young, they can live up to 30% longer. So it's a huge increase. But again, the control condition is the equivalent to, at least in my opinion, and as these animals get older, it becomes very clear, they're overeating and they're not getting enough exercise. So they're couch potatoes. As they get older, 1 year, beyond 1 year, getting to 2 years, essentially all mice and rats that under the normal conditions, they accumulate a lot of fat. Many of them will develop diabetes or insulin resistance, and they will develop a number of diseases that are known to be exacerbated or have as a risk factor being obese and overweight. So that, you know, the control conditions are conditions that actually it's probably good control for our modern society, where a lot of people are overeating too much and not getting enough exercise. And,
right, we're back to the Oreo study again.
Yeah, it's food addiction. Exactly right. So Dr. Schroeder, his work is valuable because, and actually Dr. Nora Volkow, who's the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, one of her main research interests is on food addiction, and in fact in humans, it's been clearly shown that when people eat addictive foods, if you will, and then they do imaging of their brains, the nerve cells that are activated are the same ones, as Dr. Schroeder pointed out, that are activated by drugs of abuse. So overeating really is, at the neurochemical level, very similar to what's happening with other rewarding stimuli.
But what would you say to Bob Adams? I mean, these animals are raised by the millions. He can't be running a mouse gym.
He's absolutely right. We not just putting running wheels in their cages, but even simply doing intermittent fasting or calorie restriction requires a lot more manpower to manipulate the food intake. I just think it's important that people, there may be certain key experiments that are important to repeat in animals that are maintain their conditions when they're not couch potatoes.
You know, Bob Adams, I want to ask you sort of a more overarching question. I just even getting ready for this show, I started looking at, in my primitive way, at the scientific literature. And I've spent some time on Jackson Lab sites just looking at all these, and pardon me for using this kind of layman's term, these so-called humanized mice. These mice have been genetically altered in the ways that we've been talking about to replicate certain human pre-tendencies and certain human manifestations. And I just find myself wondering, wow, I mean, it almost seems as though the development of these mice is moving very, very fast. And is it moving at the same speed as the ability of the researchers to know what they're seeing? In other words, you know, when you're looking at a macaque, you probably know pretty much what a macaque is and what a macaque is genetically and what its constituent components are as much as anybody can. But these days, with all the genetically altered mice coming into the continuum, does that require kind of a cognitive adjustment among researchers just to even understand what it is that they're seeing?
Well, there is the situation where they have to be watching for the effects of trying to determine if the gene that they've put in is causing what they're seeing or if they're seeing something related to the mouse itself.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I was asking in my bumbling way.
Right, right. Yeah, we watch that all the time. In fact, we have a group that does that. It's called phenotyping, and they try to determine if what is being seen is a result of the gene or is it a result of something else.
And Dr. Mattson, I mean, these mice, in some ways, as we said at the beginning, they're a boon to the kind of research that you're doing, at least in the sense that, you know, you skip a whole bunch of steps and you're really kind of looking at a kind of manifestation of some kind of genetic type that would be pretty hard to arrive at any other way. So I guess it's kind of a knife's edge here, right? I mean, on the one hand, you're getting these mice that are fabulous for your research. And on the other hand, you're getting a lot of mice who, in all the ways that you're talking about, are completely wrong for your research.
Well, no. I'm not saying they're completely wrong for our research. I'm just saying that their environment, you know, any phenotype, say you're looking at learning and memory or whatever, there's both genetic factors mm-hmm. that affect it and environmental factors, and it's very clear that changing the environment of laboratory animals, at least in the case of disorders and conditions that are involve the brain or behavior, can be greatly affected by the environment. And so it's important to understand how the environment affects whatever endpoints you're looking at.
Let me grab one call here before we go to break. We're going to switch topics a little bit. Actually, this will very nicely, I think, set up our next segment here. We've got David calling in from Glastonbury. Hi, David.
Hi. I just wanted to provide a little historical perspective about the progress of laboratory animals in the history of a major Midwest medical center, which will remain unnamed early in its existence. When they needed more dogs for research, one of the chiefs would take a female dog and he'd wander around the neighborhood, develop a following, and that would solve the problem. Thought that would provide a little bit of interesting perspective.
And you know, Dr. Bob Adams, I'm sure that's not happening anymore, but also, once again, in ways that we were talking about earlier in our conversation, I mean, dogs were used for a lot of things in the earlier days of medical research. I think a lot of the early breakthroughs on pacemakers and open-heart surgery was done with dogs. And I don't know to what degree dogs have been crowded out. I mean, as you were saying earlier, mice and rats are very small. They're hard to do surgery on. How big a role do dogs even play anymore?
Well, in our institution, dogs are used to a much lower level than they were used before. This year, we probably won't use over 100 dogs. Mm. Most of them are used because they're large. They have large chests, and they're being used for cardiac work, heart work. Let me just comment on that, your caller, though. I mean, that's almost like an urban legend that I've been told for years, but I don't know that I've ever seen anything documented. And people have brought that up to me, and I said, you know, if I don't have anything better to do than to drag a female dog in heat through town to get dogs, there's something wrong. You know, that's like saying animals are stolen from backyards. Perhaps they are, but they don't end up in our places.
Yeah, it does have the ring of urban legend a little bit. But anyway, all right, we'll take a quick break here. We'll come back. We want to continue this conversation a little bit more. We'd love to hear from you. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266.
Over to me, Doc. Then I'll swim around. You can punch the clock. I ain't cynical, life's a clinical trial for a mouse or a man. I'll do anything science might require. Balance on your ring or swing on your wire.
Dear National Institute of Mental Health, my name is AR16 Research Mouse 11118Z, and I'm writing to suggest you do a study of the effects of pina coladas consumed near Cancun Beach on rodents. I volunteered a, hey, lab assistant, can I get another tiny piece of paper, please? Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our intern Greg Dyson, who was, contrary to rumors, not bitten by a monkey on the second floor of the Dan Kosky building. Voiceover help in the intro by Greg Hill. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bob Barker. On tomorrow's show, Betsy Kaplan's Rockin' Garbage Show. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. We're talking about animals and research today. Our number, if you want to be part of the conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Let me tell you who's here. Dr. Bob Adams, Associate Professor in the Department of Molecular and Comparative Pathobiology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and Dr. Mark Matson, Chief of the Laboratory of Neurosciences at the National Institute on Aging, also professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. We're going to add to the conversation Dr. Andrew Rowan. He is president and CEO of the Humane Society, one of the organizations that tries to keep in touch with the scientific community about animal research. Dr. Rowan, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
My sense, looking at the Humane Society website and looking at some of your materials about animal research, is it isn't so much that the Humane Society is inalterably opposed to animal research, but you want to have a conversation with science about it, right?
Yes, that's correct. And over the years, I've had several conversations with Bob, so I just want to say greet him and say thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Andrew. Hi.
Hi.
So give us kind of a sense of the nature of that conversation. If you don't want to ban animals from research, which you clearly don't, what do you want to do? What issues are of concern to you in 2013?
Well, I mean, there are a whole lot of issues. We've been focused for the past 15 years on a pain and distress initiative, but we've also been focused for a lot longer than that on the whole issue of the testing of chemicals for safety, whether they be drugs or household products or cosmetics. And I'm very excited by recent developments that have occurred here. The National Academy of Sciences produced a report 6 years ago on toxicology in the 21st century, in which it basically predicted that we would be developing a new approach to toxicity testing, risk assessment, that would possibly end the use of animals altogether in that practice.
And when we say toxicity, how big an area are we talking about? What does toxicity testing encompass?
Well, I mean, it's a sort of a toxic effect of drugs. Drugs are generally fairly toxic molecules because they're designed to produce a biological impact effect. And so as the concentration goes up, that goes from good to bad. And then generally chemicals in the environment, there are about 80,000 chemicals that are estimated to be produced and sold through commerce. And that we need to know what those chemicals are doing. And currently, we have very little information on what those chemicals are doing. So that's been a big issue. And part of the problem is it's very slow and cumbersome to do it in animals. And so the panel in 2007 suggested a new approach that would be much faster and would produce data, information that would be about as good, perhaps better in time.
So we're talking about computer algorithms. We're talking about in silico as opposed to in vitro.
Well, not really. There's a biological component to this. You would be there's very exciting developments with stem cell biology that allows us to generate a whole range of human organ types using adult human stem cells. And then we can use those cells in high-throughput testing systems that allow you to test 1,408 chemicals at 200 different tests at 15 different concentrations in 2 weeks. And so that produces a flood of data. Mm-hmm. That now that data can be put through in silico-type systems to produce more insights and hopefully good information. It's not there yet. It's still coming. But we're very hopeful that a major push by governments around the world will allow us to start doing this sort of testing and risk assessment without using animals.
You know, Dr. Bob Adams, if I were talking to somebody maybe even a little bit more radical than Dr. Andrew Rowan, but this is something that Dr. Rowan very well may wind up saying over the course of the conversation here. You know, animal testing, kind of one of the arguments that's made anyway is that animal testing doesn't always work. It isn't always the best way, that it took in animal models a long time to see the lung cancer smoking connection, the drinking cirrhosis connection, that drugs like Vioxx get on the market because they seem to be safe in animals, and then they're not safe. How much of that argument touches you, Dr. Bob Adams, that you know, animal models can send us down blind alleys or delay implementations of warnings on certain things because the effects on humans aren't that easily replicable in animals?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that it affects me a whole lot. I wouldn't disagree with that. Mm. I think that you look at many approaches and you try to come up with the right answer. A good example of this is the drug thalidomide. Back in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, when that was used, we ended up with children with birth defects. There's two arguments with that drug. One is that it wasn't tested enough, and it wasn't tested in animals like non-human primates where it would show up. So, I mean, it puts a group like the FDA in a real quandary. You know, they have to be convinced that drugs and products are safe and effective. And how do you do that? What Dr. Rowan was explaining is on the testing side, that's a great leap forward. And where that kind of work can be used, that's wonderful. And we do the same thing. I mean, our investigators will use all those kinds of techniques if they can to supplement the animal work. Or you do the work first in vitro, and then you go into the animal to see if it's correct.
I mean, Dr. Rowan, what about what I said? I mean, this is a primary argument of animal rights groups, that the research sometimes misleads, that not everything that can be said about animal reactions to any kind of stimulus will necessarily be reproduced in the human community. Is that part of the Humane Society's position?
Well, we certainly point to those issues. One of the sort of common claims that's out there now comes from the FDA. They did a report that said that 92% of new drug entities failed, about half because they weren't effective in humans, and about half because there was unexpected toxicology in humans. And so that's not a very good success rate. Attempts to assess just how good animal testing are fairly few and far between. There was one big study done in the late 1990s, early 2000s, in which it was identified that the animal models predicted human outcomes somewhere between 40 to 70% of the time. So on average, about 55%. These new systems reach about the same level of predictive accuracy. And so, you know, we're already as good as the animal models, which have been around for 50, 60, 70 years, and the potential for improving those, the new systems, are huge. So that's one of the things that I find very exciting about this. But I'd like to go back and just comment briefly. The dog issue was raised, mm-hmm. and the dog was used a great deal in developing the heart-lung blood machine. Mm-hmm. And it ended up, in fact, delaying the use of the heart-lung blood machine in humans because the dog blood tends to coagulate more quickly, and people felt that they wouldn't have enough time in humans. Well, human blood didn't coagulate as fast. And so these are the sorts of differences that make a clean extrapolation challenging. And what we need to do is, as we develop more knowledge, we need to become much, much better at this prediction and prediction of human outcome. We're really not interested in what causes mouse diabetes. We're interested in what causes human diabetes and how to attend to it.
Dr. Mark Mattson, as you're listening to this conversation, and I know you spent 10 years on an animal care and use committee, do you foresee a time, I don't know whether the use of animals in your research is dropping off at all, I sense that maybe it isn't. Do you foresee a time in the immediate future where some of the kinds of things that Dr. Rowan is talking about will replace animal research, or are you always going to need those mice?
What Dr. Rowan was talking about is happening already. So this breakthrough that being able to take your skin cells from a human and then convert them into stem cells, and then in turn convert those stem cells into neurons or heart cells. So that technology is available, and what that does is now one, and this is being done in my field, you can take skin cells from someone who has inherited form of Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease or ALS, and you can convert those skin cells into nerve cells in a dish, and then you can ask the question, what is that defective gene doing to cause the dysfunction and degeneration of the nerve cells? And moreover, you can test then in the culture dish potential drugs that might counteract the adverse effects of that genetic problem. So that's happening, and that definitely is going to reduce the number of animals that are going to be needed. However, there's still going to be need for animals, particularly in neuroscience, but other areas, because you cannot evaluate behavior in culture dish. And, for example, you cannot study depression in your, you know, your introductory skit. Mm-hmm. They're talking about a depressed mouse or something. Mm. We don't know how to study depression in cultured cells. So at some point, there's still going to be a need, at least in the foreseeable future, for animals. But we're going to be able to reduce the number of animals, which is one of our main goals and main points of the Animal Care and Use Committees is to, are there alternatives? And we try to, if there are alternatives, we try to use them. If there are not, then there aren't. And we move forward in the in vivo animal studies.
Let me just grab a call from Brian in Wallingford, and then we'll get back to Dr. Rowan, too. Brian, a quick question for us?
Yeah, quick question. Has the issue of redundancy been brought up? Because I could just imagine all the animals, all the mice that are lean and muscular and live long, long lives because they've been on reduced calories. We know that. So why do millions and millions of these animals have to be tortured on these redundant experiments? And furthermore, I don't want to depress a monkey to help people deal with depression. I don't think that's fair to put a monkey or any kind of a primate in cages to depress them, to make them live by themselves for years.
All right, depression. Okay, that's like a whole second can of worms. Let me just, I think all we have time to tackle right now is the redundancy question. Dr. Bob Adams, what about that? He's sort of saying, well, wow, maybe you're studying the same stuff over and over again. Is that one of the thresholds that investigators have to meet?
Oh, yes. They have to address the what we call duplication. Mm-hmm. But I think I need to make sure people understand. A lot of times we do the same thing over and over again. For example, Dr. Madsen's work may require that you reduce the caloric intake of an animal. That's the base. That's what you do to then study something else. So, you know, for example, in my work with the SIV, we infect monkeys with SIV. But it's not just to see the same thing over and over again. It's to create the model of SIV infection and then to continue our studies in whatever system we're working with. So I think that's a difficult area to make people understand that people don't get funded for doing the same thing over and over again, the same studies over and over again.
I'm Dr. Andrew Rowan. You're going to have the last word, and keep in mind there's only about 60 seconds of that last word left. But I know one of the things you're trying to do is get university research facilities to sign some kind of agreement. Can you just quickly sketch out what that is?
Yes, we'd like university facilities to basically commit to ending significant pain and distress in the research. We think that that's something that is a doable target. There's a lack of trust that is fairly widespread amongst universities about our intentions here, though. So our success has been low, but it's something that we're trying to sort of say we all are agreed that pain and distress is bad for both the science and for the animals, and so we think that there's an opportunity here. But it's been a slow go.
All right. So thanks to all of you for participating in this show. Dr. Mark Madsen from Johns Hopkins and from the National Institute on Aging. Dr. Bob Adams, also from Johns Hopkins University Medical School. That was Dr. Andrew Rowan. You just heard he's the president and CEO of the Humane Society. Thanks to Kyone Wolf. This show is her baby. She brought it along. And thanks to Greg Hill, who played the depressed mouse in the intro. We did not euthanize Greg Hill.
He's a different kind of animal, and it's okay, because everyone is different in lots of different ways. He's a different kind of animal, and that's no lie. That animal is a really sweet guy. Different kind of animal. Different kind.
kind of animal. A different kind of animal.
I'm AR-16 Research Mouse 11118-C Wolf. And ever since they messed with my vocal cords for some sort of experiment, my dream of becoming a voiceover actor for movie trailers squashed. In a world. See?